Hello, this is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Dr. Daryl Roll. He is an historian and an archaeologist, and also teaches a course in digital humanities at Calvin College in the Grand Rapids area. We're going to be talking about other things besides what we did the last time he was with us. We're going to be talking about borders. We're going to be talking about the edges of culture and history and civilization and how people lived in those days when and today with borders and cultural divides. This is John Smetanka, as I say, and we're speaking with Dr. Daryl Roll, Professor of Archaeology, With Respect. So, Daryl, how are you today?
I'm great, John. Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, that's great. We're very happy to have you. When you were last here, we went through your background, how you got into archaeology and what interested you in cultures and history and the past. And we talked about, I'm going to summarize it, we have three places to look when we're examining humanity: the past, the present, and the future. And the past is everything from 5 minutes ago to the beginning of the humans walking on Earth. And the present is literally right this minute, and it can't be repeated. And then the future is, where are we going to go? What's going to happen? So, Daryl, what did you start off in writing about or researching when it came to thesis time as a PhD candidate?
Well, my PhD was on the Roman frontier in the north of Britain. In particular, I was looking at the Antonine Wall, which is a Roman frontier that a lot of people have probably never heard of. Don't know that it actually existed. It's what I like to describe as Hadrian's Wall's little brother. Most people have probably heard of Hadrian's Wall, this long stone construct that stretches from one end of Britain to the other in the north, sometimes referred to as the border between England and Scotland, which isn't correct. But they're not quite as familiar with the Antonine Wall.
Why don't you trace for us, tell us, first of all, about that Hadrian's Wall that we all have seen in history books or on TV. It still exists, parts of it. But it had a particular purpose. It went from the Irish Sea to the North Sea, right across the thin part of the main British Isle. How did it get built? And then we're going to then lead into the Antonine Wall also.
Okay. All right. Well, in the middle, around AD 117, the Roman Empire has what we call its greatest territorial extent. In the year AD 117, the Emperor Trajan expanded Roman territory to a point in which its actual the area, the total square miles of Roman territory that was controlled at any one point was at the highest number. We can't really draw a map that shows, all the territories that Rome controlled, and say that this is the Roman Empire, because that was always fluid. The Romans always had some territory that it controlled for a little bit of time, some territory that it would then would lose. And so the borders of the Roman Empire were always fairly flexible as it was expanding and contracting over the years. In AD 117, at the end of the reign of the Emperor Trajan, Roman territory reached its kind of maximum capacity. And Trajan then died, and he had his successor was new emperor from Spain named Hadrian. And Hadrian actually embarks upon a massive shift in Roman imperial policy. And this is the period in which Rome, for the very first time, begins to actually draw firm borders around its empire. It starts to say the empire stops here, and to actually mark out those locations where the empire ends. So from an ancient history and archaeological perspective, we can say that Roman frontiers begin. They are invented by the Emperor Hadrian. And in the year AD, around AD 120, I'll just use broad figures because we start getting ourselves into trouble if we try to pin things down too tightly. So around AD 120, the Emperor Hadrian visits Britain. He's been emperor for a short period of time, and he's actually just traveling across the empire. He's visiting every province. He's one of the most widely traveled of all the emperors. He visits the Middle East, he visits Northern Britain, he visits Germany, he visits all the areas in the empire. And when he hits Britain, he orders the construction of a wall. There's no previously recorded example of a Roman wall in a non-kind of city or fort context. Here he is ordering that a physical barrier be constructed from one end of Britain to the other end of Britain. According to the anonymous biographer of Hadrian, this wall was built for 80 Roman miles for the purpose of separating the Romans from the barbarians or the foreigners. And so this starts around AD 120. And we know that Hadrian's Wall was built by the Roman legions who were present in Britain at the time, and they largely built it out of stone. So Hadrian's Wall is built out of stone, and it runs from, as you said, John, from the North Sea to the Irish Sea. We would often say that it runs from the River Tyne to the Solway Firth in the west of Britain, but that's effectively some inlets coming in from the North Sea or the Irish Sea. And it's a stone wall with a series of ditches and other banks that run from one end of the island to the other, and that is punctuated along its lines by a regular series of small fortifications. The technical term for them would be fortlet, a mini fort. But in the context of Hadrian's Wall, we call these mile castles because they occur quite closely, not entirely precise, but almost exactly precise at the one Roman mile interval. So pretty much every single Roman mile for 80 miles long, you have this wall that has a fortlet, a mini fort attached to it. And along with that are a series of larger forts that are located in the vicinity of the wall. Now, this was built by the Emperor Hadrian around AD 120. And then, about 20 years later, Hadrian himself dies. And Hadrian is succeeded by a man named Antoninus Pius. And Antoninus Pius is, quite uniquely for this period in Roman history, an emperor who has no previous military credentials. He was not a military man. He was more of a bureaucrat. He was a senator that had kind of, you know, worked within the Senate, but had never actually been in military service. He had never led military units. He had never been involved physically in any sort of military campaign. And that potentially had lots of red flags and questions hanging over the legitimacy of him as emperor of a quite martial society. So we're not entirely sure why, but we believe that it's for that reason. Antoninus Pius had no military background before he became emperor. That once he became emperor, he almost immediately orders a military advance. The Romans had, up until that time, occasionally attempted to conquer the entire island of Britain, and had never really succeeded in that, or had at least just given up and decided that it wasn't worth the effort. But Antoninus Pius may have felt that he needed a military victory attributed to him and his leadership quite early in his reign in order to bolster and support his legitimate claim to the throne of Rome. So if that's the truth, and it seems to be the most likely explanation based on the evidence that we have, Antoninus Pius orders a campaign north of Hadrian's Wall into territory that we would now call Scotland, and they ended up reaching an area just north of modern-day Edinburgh and Glasgow, which is the area where the island of Britain is actually at its absolute narrowest. At that point, he ordered the construction of a new wall. There are coins minted in his name that declares victory attributed to Antoninus Pius, and a wall is constructed, this time not of stone, but of turf. So basically, there's a series of ditches and banks, and on one side of those ditches and banks is a rampart or a wall that is constructed of stacked sods, basically, to use an American term for it. And this wall was built around AD 140. It appears to have been used for about 18 to 20 years. And right around the date at which Antoninus Pius dies, right around AD 160, the Antonine Wall is abandoned, and Roman soldiers move back down to Hadrian's Wall, which remains the frontier of Roman Britain until the Romans leave Britain altogether in the early 5th century. So it appears as if the Antonine Wall was kind of conceptualized, constructed, in functional operation, and then abandoned, all within a period of about 20 years, and entirely within the reign of the Emperor Antoninus Pius. Maybe a vanity project of the emperor himself.
Now, there is a movie which I love. It's with Keira Knightley and some other guy who is portrayed. It's called King Arthur. And it talks about a focal point of the early action in that and later action is Hadrian's Wall, or I believe what is supposed to be portrayed as Hadrian's Wall. And it's all kinds of interesting stuff. There's conquest, there's treachery, there's Arthurian legends and the knights, the Salmatian knights. Instead of the Knights of the Round Table being the ones that were written of and sung in praise in the history of Britain, King Arthur is portrayed as a Roman, but his Knights of the Round Table were Salmatian warriors and horsemen that came from the steppes of Asia. Now, don't disappoint me, but is it true? Is that movie? Did you see the movie?
Yes, I've seen the movie. Once you started to describe it, I was reminded of it quite vividly. It's one of several films that use the late Roman period as a possible kind of authentic period and context for the Arthurian legends.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's the thing that I would say is absolutely true about that film and your description of it there is that the late Roman Britain and the border areas of late Roman Britain have certainly been fertile ground for the creation of stories, myths, legends. These are territories in which I like to describe them as mythic landscapes, and I think that the continuing presence of a large linear barrier like Hadrian's Wall or the Antonine Wall create fuel for telling such stories. The reality, however, is we probably cannot properly attribute King Arthur to those. There's no very good historical or archaeological evidence to support that.
You've just destroyed my image, and therefore we're going to take a break right now while I recover my equanimity. This is John Smoteka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Dr. Daryl Roll, an archaeologist, and we're talking about his work studying the Antonine Wall, the northernmost border of the Roman Empire at one point in the Roman occupation of that island. But we'll carry it on, and we're talking about more things, about borders and the Romans and value or not so much value of walls. This is John Smetanka, run with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dr. Daryl Roll, who is an archaeologist, a historian, a studier of the past, and also we'll be talking a bit about what it is to be a digital humanitarian, I guess is what I want to talk about. This is John Smetanka. So, Daryl. You've destroyed my image of the movie King Arthur. But I want to toss out some things about that, which I think will lead us to talking about the value or the use or the arising of walls and barriers and borders. Now, in the movie, there were the focal points, which were the Roman soldiers, the Roman legionnaires, who were either riding around and being massacred, or they were fighting and conquering in little battles against the Picts and the Scots, were the two tribes that were floating around in that general area, as well as the in that movie it was the Druid Merlin who was their leader, and they all went around in blue, and this was great. That was added to the atmosphere, but also you had the Saxons coming in and marching in and large thousands of warriors and going to come in north of Hadrian's Wall and come in and roust about and conquer and murder and pillage and, you know, maybe stay around for a while. That was the Saxons. Now, all right, I'm going to accept. My bubble is now burst. That not all of this is accurate, all right? But, interestingly enough, the concept of that wall, or any wall, protecting or delineating a particular area of a country has meaning, and it has value. And in fact, the Saxons did invade Roman Britain at a period of time. And there was a The Arthurian legend, as recorded by, I think it was William of Malmesbury, in his writing around 1100, as I recall, in the Chronicles of Britain, they talked about recording this guy, Arthur, son of, I don't remember his father's name, but that he rallied the native people, the native Roman Britons, and brought back the Latin language, that order and the government and culture for a period of time. And that was the golden age of Arthur. All right. Who did he fight? He fought the Saxons. Now, Britain has been known, and Churchill loved it. The Britain was this island in the middle of the world, and nothing else was, it was protected from the rest of the world by water. So that was a wall. That was a barrier. Question. We're talking about actual invasions by those powers, whether they're in Assyria or Egypt or whatever, the expansion of culture or by either military or culture or commercial force. And we're talking about this over and over again. And just take this one island. There were Saxons and Picts who didn't like the fact that the Romans were there, right?
Well,
now you're going to correct me. Yeah, this is fine.
There's a lot of mixing of certain periods in history.
All right,
in some of that,
you're going to straighten me up.
But I think a key thing for us to remember is that the Romans were not native to Britain. The Romans were themselves the invaders. The Romans invaded an island, crossing a barrier, as you said, the English Channel, as we would call it now. And the Romans actually invaded Britain on at least three occasions. We've got three occasions that are recorded in texts. The first two were in the first century BC by Julius Caesar. This is before the Roman Empire, in the final decades of the Roman Republic. And Julius Caesar invades Britain on two occasions, two summer apart. And he doesn't get very far, and he doesn't actually bring Britain into Roman territory. But instead, he finds that there are a collection of various tribes, as they're described, various independent peoples that live in relatively small-sized communities. But there's no cohesive, single kind of Britannic identity. There is no single government. There are, in fact, no kings in Britain. Instead, there are tribal chieftains, and it is Rome, Julius Caesar himself, who is responsible for appointing the first kings. He has particular tribal chieftains that are friendly to him, that respond positively, and he rewards them by declaring them king, and they are then clients of Rome. There's no question in the mind of any, there should be no question in the mind of Rome, Julius Caesar in particular, and these client kings, that even though they are kings of their kingdom in Britain, that it's the Romans who are in charge. So when the Romans are invaders, they are invaders, and there are people that, as they expand across Britain, that aren't particularly happy with the fact that they're invading. And Britain remains a very fraught island, a province of difficulty for Rome. They have to expend a lot of energy in pacifying the island, in bringing the various tribes to heel. And we're not entirely sure why they decide to draw these borders, Hadrian's Wall, the Antonine Wall, when clearly the island wasn't totally pacified. There continue to be Roman historical accounts over for hundreds of years about continued rebellion from people, potentially even on both sides of the wall. There may, in fact, have been people that are included in part of the empire by Hadrian's Wall that are starting to rebel against their foreign rulers. And there are clearly people on the other side of the wall, beyond Roman territory, that are causing difficulties. And then later on, you're right, Britain continues to be invaded. There are numerous invasions by the Angles, by the Saxons, later by the Normans. And, you know, none of these walls, Hadrian's Wall, the Antonine Wall, they are not particularly effective at stopping these invasions, for one, because we know the invasions happen and they're successful. The barrier, the natural borders, the English Channel, that proves ultimately to not be effective enough. And even the medieval, later medieval Saxon defenses along what's called the Saxon Shore are not so effective against the invading Norman army of William the Conqueror. So there's always a limit to the physical, practical effectiveness of any sort of barrier for military attack. There's also the question of, you know, are these barriers designed to prevent, you know, military attack, a change in kind of geopolitical status, or are they also designed to, you know, be barriers to cultural transmission, exchange of cultural ideas, religious ideas? Are they designed to prevent economic trade and exchange? Or are they designed to provide a means of controlling what is being exchanged, who's allowed to pass from one end to the other, when they're allowed to pass from one end to the other, and where they're allowed to pass from one end to the other? So when we think about, I think, all historical ancient frontiers or linear barriers, particular kind of manned border areas, are they designed to defend, protect, be a location for enacting and receiving customs? Are they for the controlling the movement of people and goods? Or is it a bit of a combination of all three?
It's pardon me, it is fascinating. I purposely set you up with the myths that have come down in the various writers and poets about Arthur, because it's a phenomenon, the Arthurian phenomenon of the wonderful, peaceful time when widows and orphans are respected and law is respected and language is clear and government is humane, in the magic time of the Golden Age of Arthur, is recognized as a myth. However, it has within itself kernels of something which people are constantly looking for. They're looking for peace. They're looking for the ability to raise a family. They're looking for the ability to improve the lot of their children. All of these things are built into humanity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is history. This is the way I bet you when we go around and talk about other parts of the empire, you're going to be telling me some of the same things about different parts of the Roman Empire, not just Britain, which is where we started. But we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to kind of talk about the eastern side of the empire and how, you know, your studies over there, what have helped you to understand. And then we can kind of take a little some lessons that we can learn about history. So, this is John Smetanka, Rowan with Respect, and we're talking to Dr. Daryl Roll, who is an archaeologist, a historian, and a very interesting debunker of my favorite myths, and I'm sort of unhappy about it. I won't be able to watch King Arthur again in the same light after listening to this discussion. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dr. Daryl Roll, who is, as I have mentioned, a historian, an archaeologist, and a digital humanitarian. Again, we're going to have to get a definition of that. We've been talking about the Roman Empire and walls and barriers and their purpose and whether they succeed or not. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect. So, Daryl, when we broke off, we had been talking the first part of our program today about the Roman culture, the Roman history, revolving around the Antonine Wall way up north in Scotland and the Hadrian's Wall, which is still extant around in northern England. But you also studied other parts of the Roman Empire. Tell me about that. What about the East?
Okay, well, I'm very interested in life and interaction at the edges of the Roman Empire. And from the beginning of my academic career, I decided that I wanted to understand and to think about long-term comparisons of that life and interaction using two completely separate, quite different geographical portions of the empire. So I chose the northwestern, most extent, northern Britain, probably the most extensively studied Roman frontier, the most extensively studied province of the Roman Empire outside of the central Mediterranean and Italy itself. And then the opposite extreme, the southeasternmost extent, the Roman province of Arabia, largely the modern Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. And so I have active archaeological fieldwork that I carry out there. I had a little bit of a break in looking at Jordan. I started as an archaeologist while I was an undergraduate student. I had my first archaeological fieldwork experience in Jordan, and then I went and focused for several years on northern Britain, and it was when I completed my PhD, got my first job as a professor, that I began to start closing the circle. I'm moving back to active fieldwork in Jordan, and I'm in the early stages of starting to think about how I might map out future research agendas that will be very broadly comparative between my two key areas of interest. When I described the Roman frontiers in Britain, I primarily focused on walls. You know, there are these two large linear barriers, physical constructions built by the Roman army that the Romans used to control, police, manage that particular edge of their empire. And what's interesting about this period, I said that it was the Emperor Hadrian that started the ball rolling, and then it was his successor, Antoninus Pius. It was really the reign of these two emperors in which Rome had its biggest and most elaborate kind of frontier building episode. But what's interesting about it is that they didn't execute the same strategy everywhere across the empire. They did, in fact, mark out the border. They established a system for managing the frontier on every edge, from North Africa to Eastern Europe to the Middle East to Northern Britain. But there wasn't always a wall. In some areas, for instance, across large stretches of Eastern Europe, they've got the Danube. The river Danube forms a natural frontier. No wall was needed. Other areas, there were large mountain ranges that could serve. In the Middle East, in Jordan, you have the desert, which is kind of a natural barrier to controlling the movement of goods and peoples. It's not easy to cross the desert. They're not going to really expect a massive army, raging across the desert, except for at known locations where they may be able to pass. So Rome actually, in terms of the logistical arrangements, the architecture of the border itself, the frontier, was substantially different. In Jordan, what we largely see is a road, a Roman road that kind of skirts the desert fringe. And along that road, you have periodic forts that are situated. Much larger gaps between the forts that we know about on the eastern frontier in Arabia than the roughly 7 miles between forts on Hadrian's Wall, or only 2 miles between forts on the Antonine Wall. In Jordan, we can go 20, 30 miles in between forts. So from that perspective, it's quite different. My work that I do in Jordan up to this date, though, has actually been of a different character as well. So while I've been looking in northern Britain at particularly Roman military sites, the Roman military frontiers, the wall itself, which was a military structure, in Jordan, I'm looking at more civilian sites, actual communities, towns, villages. And I've been working for a number of years at a place called Tel Hespan, which is a site that was originally excavated as a biblical archaeology site. It has been considered for a long time to be Heshbon, biblical Heshbon, which is described in the Book of Numbers as one of the first conquest sites following the Hebrew exodus from Egypt. It's where Moses and the Israelites defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, at his capital city of Heshbon. And I've been particularly interested in the Roman and Byzantine occupations there. So a site that dates back at least to the Iron Age, so around 1000, maybe 1200 BC. There's clear archaeological evidence for occupation there then, all the way through to the 1920s, kind of the end of the Ottoman Empire. So the site was pretty much kind of consistently occupied for at least 3,000 years. And I focused in particular on that Roman and Byzantine periods.
I know what the Roman period is, and I think I know what the Byzantine period. Explain what that is.
So, in the context of Roman history, we have around 300 A.D. We have the Emperor Constantine, and the Emperor Constantine relocates the Roman capital from the city of Rome itself to a place called Byzantium, an ancient city that's sitting basically at the location of modern-day Istanbul in Turkey. The site was called Byzantium up until that point, but as Roman emperors do, you like to put your name on things. So the city of Byzantium is renamed Constantinople after the Emperor Constantine. And you have a very firm division of the Roman Empire from just being kind of a single empire to actually having two discrete components to it. You have the Eastern Roman Empire, which is based out of the capital city of Constantinople. And you have the Western Roman Empire, which continues to largely be ruled from the old traditional capital of Rome itself. Now, importantly, the people who lived in the Eastern Roman Empire considered themselves part of the Roman Empire. They would have called themselves Romans. And the term Byzantine Empire is a term that modern historians apply to the Eastern Roman Empire, referring to the fact that it is based out of what had previously been called Byzantium.
Mm-hmm.
And when in the late 5th century, around AD 475, the Western Roman Empire falls and is no longer controlled, it's no longer being operated as it had been for centuries, the surviving Roman Empire is entirely located in the east. So the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, is largely a distinctly Christian continuation of the glory that had been Rome, now located in an Eastern context, located within modern-day Turkey, centered at the city of Constantinople, Byzantium, Istanbul. They're all the same names.
When I was growing up, I read a book by Richard Halliburton, talked about the modern, the wonders of the ancient and the modern world. And one of the places that I fell in love with when I was probably 9 years old was the town, the village, the city of Petra, which is in Jordan.
Yes.
And I think everybody who has watched Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, as I recall, in the Last Crusade,
yep.
Knows Petra. But what is this an example of one of the civilizations that was going not just in ancient times, but on through the Roman time?
That's a really good question. Yes. Most people are familiar with Petra as the canyon of the crescent moon, mm-hmm. where the Holy Grail, the final resting place of the Holy Grail from Indiana Jones film. And Petra was the one of the capital cities of a group of people called the Nabataeans. Now, the Nabataeans, they were a Near Eastern, we could probably say that they were an Arab civilization that emerged in some sort of a murky fashion. We're not entirely sure of earliest Nabataean history, but they emerge in kind of the second half of the first millennium BC. Okay, so from about 500 BC onward, we start to have some historical references to people that may be the Nabataeans, or that may eventually become what we would call the Nabataean kingdom. And they rise as a civilization, in particular following the conquest of Alexander the Great around 300 BC. And Alexander the Great connected east and west by having a great conquest that connected the Mediterranean world with the world of Persia and India and China. And the ancient world from that time onward were particularly keen to have access to spices and silks and all sorts of goodies that were coming from India, China, and the Far East. And the physical environment was not very good. Those corridors between the Eastern, the Far Eastern world of India and China, and the world of the Middle East, and then of the rest of the Mediterranean and West, that was very difficult territory. And you either had very, very difficult, dangerous sea voyages, or you had somehow to bring goods across the desert. And the Nabataeans were a desert people who had territory that bordered on the Persian Gulf. So they had access to sea routes that could be coming in. But they also understood the desert. They knew where all the oases were in the desert. And so the Nabataeans were one of several key groups that were middlemen. They controlled the trade routes between India and China and the kind of Hellenistic and Roman and later empires. And it's the Nabataeans who were responsible for building that great kind of rose-red carved city of Petra. And they eventually became client kings of Rome. So they were semi-independent. They ruled their own territory, but they paid tribute to Rome in order to continue to be able to do that. And eventually, they were annexed by the Roman state. The Nabataean kingdom ceases to exist. And around AD 106, the former Nabataean kingdom now becomes part of the Roman Empire formally. And it is the Nabataean territory that actually becomes, at that point, AD 106, the Roman province of Arabia, which is where my research and active field work is primarily based.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Dr. Daryl Roll, who is a historian, archaeologist, and has been talking about the role of history in learning about the past, and also about the Roman Empire, which is his area of specific interest, from the northwest of the Roman Empire in northern Britain on now to we're talking about the eastern edge of the Roman Empire and the turbulent times that all, as I said before, the tectonic plates of empires just kept grinding on each other and produced something. So this is John Smetanka running With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Dr. Daryl Roll, who is an archaeologist, professor of archaeology and history at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, but before that worked as a professor at the University of Durham in England and has been doing field research on the extremities of the Roman Empire and everyday life in the times of the Roman Empire and history generally. This is John Smetanka. So, Daryl, you described that the Roman Empire under Hadrian began to try to come up with some form of definition of how far they extended, and that before then it was more fluid than later on. What were some of the ways that they did? And let's start talking about the role of private life. What kind of life did the folks live? Let's talk about the eastern part of the empire. What was did they see? We know they didn't see walls, but we did see roads, and we saw forts. And that was a way of, you know, the extension of government. But what about the average life of folks there?
Ooh, that's a big topic. I think that, you know, in a lot of respects, ancient life was probably first and foremost occupied with the quest for food. And that's something that actually is quite important. Even getting into some modern history as well, that we need to understand just how much time and energy ancient people spent on finding, processing, producing, consuming, and disposing of everything that is involved with food, eating, consumption. You know, we all need to eat to live. And you know, earliest people, you know, were what we call hunter-gatherers. You know, their entire life was all about going out and hunting for food and gathering food. Well, people later who were no longer hunter-gatherers and were kind of settled farmers, they still spent a lot of time hunting and gathering food in one form or another. And I think that we sometimes lose our ability to really comprehend just how enormous an effort that was. That people would need to actually, you know, not only go buy grain flour to make bread, you know, they couldn't go out and just buy bread. They actually had to make bread. But before you can make bread, you have to make flour. Before you can make flour, you have to harvest the grain, you know. So there's all these processes that are involved, and that occupied a lot of time without modern technologies.
I'm taking it as a part of your message that there were no supermarkets, there was no coolers with milk and meat and cheese all in one building.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Because of that, you had to go to this market stall to buy lentils. You had to go to this market stall to buy olives. You had to go to this market stall to buy bread or flour or the grain that you were gonna then grind in order to produce your own flour to make the bread that you were making. You had to build your own oven. You know, you couldn't go buy an oven. So I think that's probably the first and most important message, is that up until really the modern world of refrigeration and mass production, that most people spent significant amount of their time in some aspect of, and various aspects of, the what we would call the food system. And that's actually been a really crucial part of a lot of the archaeological projects that I've been involved with, where we've tried to, particularly in the Middle East, where we have sites that have been occupied for not only, you know, decades and hundreds of years, but actually multiple millennia, to be able to try to tell the big picture, to tell the full story, as full of a story as we can about that place. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to trace kind of cycles and processes in the food system. How did people find food? What kind of food did they grow? And we can tell a lot about ancient society by looking at that. So the last time I was here, we talked a little bit about how little bits of archaeology, little pieces of information can tell us about daily life. Well, you know, those things can tell us about the food system. They can tell us, for example, if there's lots of, if I'm finding in an archaeological soil layer, olive pits, that tells me that they're consuming olives. That probably tells me that olives are growing in very close proximity to the site. If I'm finding olive pits in association with cattle bones or with horse and donkey bones, that tells me that people are probably actually living here in permanent settled homes, because to grow olives, that takes an enormous investment of time. You don't plant an olive tree and come back to it periodically to check. You need to nurture that olive tree. You need to, you know, the decision to plant olives is a statement that we're going to stick around here. We're going to invest our time in this location. But then we have periods in which there are no olives. There are no kind of traction animals like cattle, like horses, like donkeys that could pull a plow. Instead, we find basic kind of cereals, crops that can be grown for one season only and then never go back to that field. And we find mostly sheep and goat bones there. We can tell that those people are probably largely semi-nomadic, pastoral people. They may be settling down for a couple of years, but they're not staying long term. And we can piece together longer kind of narratives of settlement pattern just by looking at little pieces like olive pits and animal bones. And I think that's a really fascinating part of it.
We could talk about this forever because I'm fascinated by it. And I think our listeners as well, to find out the direct line between ourselves and our ancestors on basics, as you say, food. And we haven't even talked about water, which is essentially essential for agriculture or crops or people. I mean, and the whole picture. Yeah. And then you go on, you have to have space to do this. And you have to be, it goes on and on and on. And these are the things which follow through from ancient times to the present times. Because we're still fighting over, I'm told that futurists say that the big battles in the future will not be about territories, they'll be about water. And who's got access to fresh water? Well, this is fascinating because we have the ocean is covered, 7/8 of the world is covered by ocean, but we don't tap the water in the same way we have to, like the Great Lakes where we have fresh water. At any rate, unfortunately, we're going to have to come to a conclusion here. And on one last question, would you have just about a minute or two on this? And I know this is hard. Borders and edges of civilizations. How do you see the value or the lack of value of a border?
I think borders are, first we need to understand that all borders are artificial. Borders are imposed by people, by societies, by cultures. And ultimately, they are designed to protect protect or control access to something of value, whether that is valuable natural resources like access to water, whether it's natural resources of oil, whether it's something that's not the same kind of value, but historical value, cultural value, like a burial ground. So we draw lines, we draw borders in order to protect things that we value as individuals, as societies. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I think that's actually a valuable thing, but we need to be very, very careful about really understanding why are we going to build a wall? Why are we going to establish a border? What is it designed to protect or control? And why is that thing valuable and who is it valuable to?
And here we must stop, but it leads to another further discussion of this at some point in the future, and I would love to have you come back and talk about a lot of other things that you found in your studies, your archaeological studies, which flow through to today and tomorrow. Dr. Daryl Roll, thank you very much for joining us on With Respect. It's been a pleasure, and I hope that you come back and join us again.
Thank you very much.
This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and remember, our mantra is If you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.